My name is Bill Grace, and I'm from the Center for Ethical Leadership in Seattle, Washington. And today we're going to be looking at the question, what is right action? And to do that, we're going to be reading a poem together, a 3,000-year-old poem by Chang Su. Some of you may know this author and writer. And it's entitled The Woodcarver. What I'd like to do is to ask everyone to read it first to yourself. And I have one volunteer to read the first two stanzas. What I'd like to do is to get another volunteer to read the second two and pardon the dark copy at the bottom. But if there's a third person who would read the final two stanzas, that would be great. So do you want to volunteer for the middle two? Bam. And Dean, would you volunteer for the last two?
Yes.
Okay. So for right now, let's just take 3 or 4 minutes to read the poem. And if I'll leave extra copies on both sides of the room, there's some there. Help any latecomers find copies, if you will. Chance to read the poem. Okay. Would you start by reading the first two, and then Anne, and then Dean?
Sure. The woodcarver. King, the master carver, made a bell stand of precious wood. When it was finished, all who saw it were astounded. They said it must be the work of spirits. The Prince of Lu said to the master carver, "What is your secret?" King replied, "I am only a workman. I have no secret. There is only this. When I began to think about the work you commanded, I guarded my spirit, did not expend it on trifles that were not to the point. I fasted in order to set my heart at rest. After 3 days fasting, I have forgotten gain and success. After 5 days, I had forgotten praise or criticism. After 7 days, I had forgotten my body with all its limbs."
Thank you.
"By this time, all thought of your highness and of the court had faded away. All that might distract me from the work had vanished. I was collected in the single thought of the bell stand. Then, I went to the forest to see the trees in their natural state. When the right tree appeared before my eyes, the bell stand also appeared in it. Clearly, beyond doubt, all I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin.
If I had not met this particular tree, there would have been no bell stand at all. What happened? My own collected thought encountered the hidden potential in the wood. From this live encounter came the work which you ascribe to the spirits."
What I'd like to do, actually, would be to spend the remaining time, 45 minutes, looking at four themes in this poem, and then anything else that you'd like to add, and we're going to start with the anything else, okay? The four themes I want to get to, however, and we'll see. We may get there on our own, and I'll put these on the board at the right time. Our motives, skills, and gifts, and this is to another session. Is it that this evening, Brian?
Yes.
Spiritual gifts.
Yeah.
And then the question of the other, in parentheses, and then finally results. But Before we get to any of those themes, I'd like to see what reactions you have. The theme of this session is right action. What does it mean to engage in right action? And but in light of that, or outside the light of that, what is it about the poem that strikes you? Anything speak to you immediately? Brad?
7 days of fasting,
okay,
which I would just as soon forget, are the place at which he is disengaged from the usual motivations for action.
Okay.
Take it in.
Did you?
I was just going to say, no distractions, right, going through those days, and just a focus on the piece of wood.
Okay. Dean?
Taking him totally out of himself, put the normal distractions away so that he has nothing but the bell stand as a picture.
Mm-hmm.
Still adding on to that, I mean, it's kind of simplifying it. He's getting down to the root basis of his existence. His focus obviously is on eating because he's fasting, so he's broken it down into this most basic of needs and whatnot, so he's not, his thoughts have completely simplified. I mean, that's, I guess, just a trend.
Okay, thanks.
Seeking an affinity with the other and seeking to perceive the possibility in the other strikes me.
Okay. Dwayne?
Well, it's very much related to that, but the harmony between the tree and the artisan, between nature and the human maker, there, that particular tree, yeah, that sort of struck me. Without that, there would have been no bell stand,
right, because
that tree presented the potential.
Because I think we're, a lot of the comments, although not the last two, a lot of the comments were focusing on the first question of motives. Let's just take a deeper look. And don't be limited by any structure I put up on the board here. If something speaks to you, feel free to explore it. But let me see if I can direct us a little bit more specifically in a couple areas for the sake of depth. We're talking about motives. Why is King doing this? Is it art for art's sake? Why is King doing this to begin with?
Commissioned it.
Okay, who said he was? He was commanded by, and Van was saying he was commissioned. How? Those are two different words. Commissioned, commanded. What makes you think he was commanded?
It says, well, King's reply that I began to think about the work he commanded.
Okay. This is a 3,000-year-old poem. What power does the Prince of Lu have? What sort of system of government is this?
It's absolute power.
He's a feudal lord, right? Princes were feudal lords. These are feudal days. He has absolute power. If the Prince of Lu wanted to and said, off with his head, there would be probably several people in Lu's kingdom who would be willing to jump to that command as well. The question for us is, who is the Prince of Lu in our lives?
Bill, the Prince of Lu obviously could simplify or symbolically be something within you too, right? You
okay.
could have a Prince of Lu, which is an absolute power, say money or greed or something that's driving you.
Okay.
That, you know, you have to do this, something's commanding you each and every day to do this and do that, as opposed to a Prince of Lu, right?
That's the
external.
Okay, very good. So what are some examples of Prince of Lu, not specifically in your own lives, but what are examples of some Princes of Lu that people might have in their lives here at the dawn of the 21st century?
Bigger house?
Professional divans.
Okay. A board of trustees.
guiding their children through the maze of whatever.
Okay. But who are the people in our culture today who we could allow to have lordship over us?
Our bosses.
Bosses.
Probation officers.
Foundation officers? Is that what you said?
Probation.
Probation officers, okay. I was, you know, I'm in the nonprofit world, so I thought.
possibly religion run amok.
Okay.
Sort of spiritual leaders that maybe are.
Jim Jones.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, I mean, that's at one major.
Right.
Field, but there's others in the within.
Okay.
Middle ground.
Okay.
Or religious leaders not run amok.
Okay.
I mean, just sort of the hierarchical structures of
organized
religion.
I'm sorry.
Service clubs.
Okay.
Coach.
If King lives in a culture where the King of Lou really does have power and authority over him, can you describe, we talked about this a little bit, how does King begin his journey towards freedom?
He goes to the forest.
Well, let's take a look.
Fasting.
Okay, say some more about that, Dean.
Say more about it?
Yeah.
Oh.
How does fasting help him move towards freedom?
It slows his heart down.
Say, who said that? Yeah, how do you know it slows his heart down?
He said.
Tell us about it.
I fasted in order to set my heart at rest.
Mm-hmm.
And later says, forgot my body with all its limbs. Set himself aside from himself.
How about earlier in the poem? What's one of the first things he does?
He guards his spirit.
Guards his spirit. What does that mean? What does it mean in our culture today to guard our spirit?
Be cautious.
Boundaries.
Cautious.
Cautious? Talk about boundaries, Dwayne.
That we just don't have that distinction between ourselves and others, and we have no self, because others, we allow people to be in space that is sacred and ought to be our space.
Okay.
And even if there is no hierarchical society with, you know, overlords over it, you have others that will not allow yourself to be.
Dean and I were talking about this sort of after lunch. Even Jesus, in the midst of his ministry, giving himself away to people, oftentimes would go away to a quiet place or a lonely place to pray. Mm-hmm. Ben?
Another possible way of looking at it is in order to center oneself.
Okay.
To not be dissipated, so that my spirit is and my attention is all over, but is in fact here and focused about what I want to be and do.
One of the things I love about Holden Village is all the different ways to practice that. One of the ways I've been trying, not as regularly as I'd like, is the pot shop. And a couple of the potters have told me that the first thing you need to do is center the clay. Then they made the mistake of telling me that in order to center the clay, you need to be centered. I came in kind of going, I've only got 5 minutes. So, you know, can you breathe, Bill? And, you know, can you center yourself? And if you center yourself, maybe you're more apt to be able to center the clay.
The difficulty with that is we rarely discuss ourself as ourself. We usually discuss ourselves in relation to other people and how they affect us. So centering ourselves, I guess we confuse it with relating it to with other people and becoming a part of them, thinking that we're getting centered and understood.
In the context of our Christian tradition, what would it mean to start each day by guarding our spirit and centering ourselves?
I think before you guard, you must know your spirit.
Okay.
Or come to a formulation of different ologies and know what your personal spirit is. So okay. Even before that, guarding.
Okay, so as we come to know our spirit, let's just take a moment and think about that. What would it mean to begin some regular practice of guarding our spirit, centering ourselves so that our hearts might be at rest. What are, in the Christian tradition now, what are some things that we could do to practice that?
Ask God to allow us to use the fruit of the Spirit of love, joy, peace, patience.
How do you do that, practically, Dean?
Mine is I pray that before I get out of bed.
Okay, so early morning prayer.
Simply quiet. Even though you've been sleeping in quiet, you need some, you know, while you are conscious here, that just have this sort of almost total lack of sort of sounds or distractions.
Breathing. Being glad you can suck air.
Do you spend time during the day just doing that?
Yes, especially out here, nice and fresh.
Focusing.
Yeah.
I think when I'm a teacher and I spend 7-8 hours a day in contact with groups of people, groups of adults who quite often have a lot of stress and strain and pressure on their lives, and I get drawn into that a lot, and if I take time, different points during the day, just to separate myself from that and to quiet myself, that tends to give me what I need to continue.
For about the last 7 years of my life, I have been trying to make it a daily practice in the morning of beginning the day in what has sort of become almost a monastic tradition for me. And because I am using materials from a 1,500-year-old monastic tradition to guide me in prayer, I find it a very powerful way of centering myself and setting my heart at rest. I ordered about 20 copies, I think, of this book, and there's about 5 left. This happens to be one of their copies. I left mine in my room. I just wanted to pass that around. If it speaks to you, you might try it. But I encourage you to find something that that you're comfortable with, that is close to your own tradition, that this speaks to me. It may or may not speak to you. But to begin a daily process of centering ourselves and setting our heart at rest is a good discipline I've discovered in a busy culture. That it's difficult, actually, I find it, to find quiet places. I can wake up to a clock radio. I don't, but it's possible to wake up to a clock radio and then to leave the radio on while you're making breakfast, turn the radio on in the car and get to work and have a busy day and come home and watch television. You could easily spend a lifetime in this culture without ever having found any time for quiet that might set our hearts at rest.
I was just thinking about that too in terms of the word guard. Mm-hmm. It implies not letting certain influences in that can make you just go off on tangents or really have a mindset that's really quite negative about living on a daily basis. You know, you can be launched off into work thoughts without even thinking about it. You can be launched off into criticizing people mentally, even before you're out of bed. And I also think of the media and television and all that stuff that comes at you, like the radio. And you know, that to me implies just putting up some boundaries about what you will let come into you.
Thanks for coming, guys. I know you've got to get back to work. Anything else in terms of the first question of motives? One of the observations that I'd like to make, and see if you can help me connect this, that King is able to move from external motivations to internal motivations. We've sort of talked about this already, but what is the importance of that, moving from external motivations to internal motivations? He still is going to build the bell stand, right? But at this point, his motivations have changed. The locus of his control is internal rather than external. My question is, so what? What difference does that make?
I think the internal motivations kind of purify his skill. It seems like a form of asceticism, which is very foreign to this culture that we live in, I think.
Yeah. I was just thinking this of our common prayer in the evening has reminded me of the use of light. And when King here talks about guarding the spirit and not expending it on trifles that are not to the point, thinking of, well, what is it that I want to do? And if we said that that was something like a thing to see, it would make a lot of difference if there were a colored light coming from that side and a colored light coming from that side, and all the different ways in which shadows would interpret what it is that I'm doing. What I'm trying to do is get rid of all of those so that, in fact, then I can see what is there in the perspective that I want to see it as, so that, in fact, I can move forward. And the other things are just distractions, trifles, that are getting in the way of my seeing it as it is so that I can do it.
That's wonderful.
Just on a practical level, I think that work that I have somehow owned, that I believe in, there is much more heart in it and much more quality in it than if it's coming from outside. My boss wants me to do something I don't really agree with. It's a whole different thing from, yeah, I think that's right, and I'm going to do a really good job.
Is fear King's motivation after he's fasted for 7 days?
No.
Oh. I wonder how many people in the Prince of Blues village motivation is fear. And what is King's motivation now if it's not fear? Do you think? What could it be?
I think it's making the bell stand that he saw when he discovered the tree. You know, he saw the bell stand in the tree. And how can he form that with his hand and his tools just as he visualized it?
Mm-hmm. Now, maybe his motivation now is beauty, right? And three of the noblest motivations I can think of might be love, beauty, and justice. But how do we free ourselves of all of the other motivations that are probably fear-based to get to the point where we're only motivated by justice and by love and by beauty? And I would imagine, having not been there in my life that often, that that must be a very powerful way to live one's life. Anything else, sort of under the heading of motivations, that's striking you? And not really, probably about the first two stanzas. Anything else that's jumping out at you?
King does not describe how he felt when he encountered the hidden potential in the wood. But perhaps the encounter itself was important for his motivation.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe something transcendent happened when he saw that tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very powerful, I think, Brad. I really like the word remember. You know, if we just think about it just a little bit different, to remember. And that has something about the hidden wholeness in the wood, that there is a connection between King and the tree. And when he remembers that relationship, when he associates himself in relationship with the wood, that now there's a new level of motivation that comes out of that relationship. One of the things that Walter Brueggemann talks about is in this book, Prophetic Imagination, he observes, and I've not gone back and looked at it, although now I'm motivated to, he observes that each time before Jesus engaged in an act of healing, he sought first to be in relationship with that person, especially their pain and anguish. And it was only after Jesus had connected himself to the anguish of the other, Brueggemann argues, that he was then and only then capable of healing. The wonderful scene with Lazarus, come, for Lazarus has died. Jesus wept. And it is in that connection, that desire to be connected, that creativity, including healing, is possible.
I have a question.
Yeah, Dean and then Dwayne.
Go ahead.
Well, nothing is said here about how or why he was commissioned to do this, and why a person with such power as the Prince of Lu would even be concerned about how he did it.
Okay, we're gonna be coming to that in just a bit, but that's a good observation, Dean. It's a nice segue. We're gonna move into the question of skills and gifts. Let's hear from Dwayne and then Van.
I was struck here by the transition between these two, stanzas, and then I was collected in a single thought of the bell stand, and now he was sort of totally focused upon the creative work. Then I went to the forest to see their trees in their natural state.
Right.
That move, I mean, it got me then. Therefore, you know, when I focused here, I went to see the trees in their natural state.
To me, yeah, that's beautiful, Dwayne, because that's like the potter telling me, you know, once I had settled aside all my other distractions, once I had become centered and the clay was centered, then the coffee mug. Yeah. You know, I could go look for the coffee mug in the clay. You know. Dan?
Since the only description we have of King is that he is a master carver, I was thinking of what a master carver, having been given a bell stand to do, would do. And so that he could actually see where the bell stand was to be. What is the function of a bell stand? What kind of a bell? I mean, all of the attention that a master carver would have to have relative to what he was carving and what it was for and where it would be and what, I mean, and that is to have everything else gone away from one's attention so that one can be about only, about the bell stand.
Wonderful. Yeah. When I read this poem, and I've used it several times with groups now in leadership settings with busy chief executive officers, you know, we can just spend the whole time in those first two stanzas. And I just begin to see these people sink in their chairs and begin to breathe, you know, for the first time in a long time. You know, when was the last time they gave themselves the luxury of pulling back from the to-do list, of pulling back from the day planner, from the board's expectations, from everybody's needs, and to finally be, you know, focused on the mission and the vision of the organization. I oftentimes think that's where the noblest aspirations of the organization are in the question of vision and mission. That's the whole notion that you're getting at around the bell stand. Once focused on that, then, you know, we can get about the creative work of doing it, but we get hooked in all of the trifles and all of the organizations we're a part of, and especially leaders of organizations, if we don't take time to step back and remind ourselves of the bigger picture, the purpose, the bell stand, you know, we can find ourselves being preoccupied with maybe the smaller, less important questions. Let's move on a little bit and keep focusing where you're drawn to. We'll let the spirit move freely here, and I mean that very seriously. If the spirit is in the conversation, pay attention to words or phrases that you're drawn to, because that may be the spirit speaking through you, and we need to hear that. But I would like to focus on the question of skills and gifts. We've been here a little bit. Let me go to, I'm looking for where it is. It's in the first stanza. The people say that this must be the work of spirits. And the prince says, what's your secret? This must be the work of spirits. And the Prince of Lu looks at the bell stand, what's your secret? And what does King reply?
I am only a workman, I have no secret.
I am only a workman, I have no secret. And I say, thank God for that response. If King's response was, well, thank you very much. You know, I've worked very hard at becoming a master carver, and, you know, and if you work as hard as me, you know, you can get there too someday. I have no secret. I am only a workman. If we believe that the work that Dr. Martin Luther King did was the work of the spirits and had some secret, then we can live a comfortable life believing that we can never do that. So why aspire to it? If we believe that Mother Teresa is a saint, and like many other saints, one of my questions sometimes is, when we make people saints, do we really abandon them to sainthood and put them up in a statue or in an icon or on a picture frame and look at them, but at arm's length, knowing that, you know, they were touched by God in some special way, and then maybe under my breath, thank God, boy, I don't have to live that life. Celebrities versus citizens, you know, is the question here. If the work of God is only, if only certain people are capable of that, capable of the work of Dr. King or Mother Teresa, and it's only for God's celebrities, then what about the rest of us? Aren't we off the hook? But when King says, I'm only a workman, my sense is that puts us right on the hook. What's your reactions there?
Well, back in those days, those in power were very jealous of those who had secrets that they didn't have. So when I... Am I reading your mind?
No, yes, I think you're right on.
When he says, what is your secret? The first thing I think of is he wants to know, give that secret to me.
A little more power, huh?
Yes, yes.
And you're fearful of those power.
Okay.
And why, you know, monarchs usually want to control the priests and the society because they realize that they have access to power and that power must be under their authority.
That horrible story about Ivan the Terrible, I don't know if you've heard this story. I had the chance to visit the Soviet Union as a younger person, and when I was getting a tour of Red Square, the Russian tour guide said that when Ivan the Terrible had St. Basil's Cathedral commissioned, that's that wonderful cathedral in Red Square with all the cupola, and Ivan the Terrible said to the architect, what a beautiful, beautiful building. Do you think you could make one more beautiful than this? And the architect thought, probably. And so Ivan the Terrible had his eyes gouged out.
Wow.
To your point, Dean.
I see King saying, I'm only a workman, and feeling if we all took that role of being only a workman and what he did with that, it would be astonishing for everything.
Ben? I'm thinking of the guilds and the master workman is somebody who only does a little bit, but nobody can get the job unless they go through apprenticeship, mm-hmm. and then journeyman, and then master. And it was all a secret.
Uh-huh.
You, because you wanted, it's like, you know, it's kind of the way in which unions can control, you know, who can even lift one thing from another, you know, uh-huh. into a light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
And this person is saying, this is not about, you know, things that are not yours and accessible if you want to do them. All you have to do is want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's explore something actually related to that. What's the difference between a gift and a capacity? I don't mean to play with words here, but I'm trying to make a distinction. Those are the two words that I find helpful. What's the difference between a gift and a capacity?
A capacity, you may have to have a higher level of tolerance because you can do it to get the job done.
Okay.
Whereas a gift, it's more flowing.
Okay. How do I get a gift?
somebody gives it to me. It's outside of my control that I have it.
How do I get a capacity?
I build a skill over time.
Okay. Or I have the capacity.
Okay.
I need to realize it and take responsibility for it.
To me, a capacity can be a gift unused or undeveloped.
Okay.
You have maybe a talent, but you don't practice it or put it to use.
See if I can make this distinction to get to a point about gifts, and it may be a segue, I hope, for Brandon to what he's doing, is that, and I think it's to your point, I believe that gifts are bestowed, and that capacities are something that we can earn and develop. For example, in all modesty, people have helped me to see over the last several years that I think I've been given a gift for creating verbal pictures and helping people to understand things through the use of words, and sort of call that rhetorical leadership. I didn't earn that. I didn't know I had it. People helped me to see, actually, that I had that gift. Writing, on the other hand, is not a gift that I have. And I am working hard to develop that capacity because I'd also like to share my ideas in written form. Why are gifts... I believe that gifts are a threat to us, ultimately, because they somehow offend our ego. Why could that be true?
Well, God gives us capacity to receive a gift when we accept Jesus Christ as our Savior. He also has gifts that He gives us. We have the capacity to exercise those gifts. But the gift to do it is something we have to go back to God and ask Him to guide us,
okay,
to show us the way.
So if a gift has been given, we may not be fully sure how to utilize it, and so we need to be in relationship with God even to know how to apply it. I'm going to make the argument here for the sake of discussion that I think we align ourselves more easily with our capacities, the things that we've earned, the things that we've worked hard at through the sweat of our brow and the blisters on our fingers. We align ourselves with those things because we've done them the old-fashioned way. We've earned them. And I think it is more difficult in this culture to align ourselves with our gifts. They've been bestowed. And I have this sense that sometimes in our culture we don't trust them because we don't know how we got them. You know, you didn't earn them. You just sort of been given it. If that's true, and you kick it around with me if you think it's not true, what would we have to do in culture to become more comfortable with the notion of the fact that we have gifts and become more comfortable and discerning those and learning those?
Sorry, I have to leave, Bill.
See you, Dean.
You hit on an interesting point when you mentioned your gift, you said, in all humility. And I think that's probably a stumbling block for many people to admit maybe that they have gifts because of a humble spirit.
You have to be receptive. You can't always be proactive if you're going to acknowledge gifts. There's a way in which you have to kind of live out of gratitude rather than acquisition.
Okay, great. Do you think our school systems are set up to help young people discover what their gifts are?
I haven't been in one of them for a while, but no, I don't think so.
Connie?
I'd certainly say no, but that's not the only place. I don't think, for example, my son Will's gifts are ever drawn out in our life at home the way they are here. But I think when people have time, which a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people have to work and take care of kids and stuff that I don't have to do now like I did when I had six kids at home and was working too. I think when you have time, it's easier to discover your gifts.
Okay. I think there's some pain involved in having gifts because it sometimes sets you apart from others.
What does Paul suggest? The Apostle Paul. Do some have gifts and others don't?
Another variety of gifts.
And set up in such a way that they're dependent upon each other.
Build up and divide.
I just think, as I read this poem, I'm just struck that, you know, we live in a culture that is very work-oriented. The good old Protestant work ethic is alive and well. And that most of the things that we have in life, we believe most good things in life that we get, we need to earn. And would it be a radically different culture, school system, workplace, church, if we believed that the best things in life were bestowed and we had to open our hearts to accept them versus sort of prepare our backbone and spine and you know, develop the true grit to develop these capacities and then, you know, use them in the marketplace cleverly. I just say, what a different culture. A culture based on capacities versus a culture based on gifts. Parker Palmer says that there are four steps in moving towards a life oriented around gifts. It's the first being a place, maybe a meditative place, but also, I believe, relationships where we can see our gifts. And he says, once we are allowed to see our gifts, to your point exactly, he says we have to accept them. And once we accept them, we have to claim it. And then once we have claimed it, then we have to nurture it. And I just think, what a different school system that would be. What a different church that might be. And,
as soon as you said Paul, though, and we're reminded of the gifts that are given to us, I'm struck by the purpose of the gift, and that it is not mine, and it is not for me.
Thank you.
And that is not part of gifts in any of the even giving, gift giving that we do, say, at Christmas time. I give it to you, and it is yours. It is then your possession, and you get to use it any way you want. And that is not so for the gifts of the Spirit.
What are the gifts of the Spirit for?
For the building up of the body. For the good of the whole.
Where do we teach each other that in our culture? Absolutely. Brad, I absolutely believe that. I think that's one of the things that we deeply... I deeply appreciate about the Village is that the gifts are everywhere, and the Village has the eyes to see, to ask people to share their gifts for the community. Vespers is an incredible stage for that. I mean, it seems every evening there's another... you know, new gift shared from a member of the dish team, or you know, somebody sits down and plays Chopin, and then does our dishes. You know, I absolutely agree, Bryn. Well, we have about 10 minutes left. Let's explore whatever you want to explore. Were you going to say something?
No, I was going to say sometimes in families, gifts are. I think in an ideal family, you recognize, people recognize each other's gifts in a good family.
Mm-hmm. And not only recognize them, but I think
yeah, encourage them. Mm-hmm.
I wish I had known a lot more about that as a parent earlier. I recognize it now in the last 4 or 5 years to sort of be more mindful of watching my children and trying to observe their gifts and nudge them towards the best use there. But I wondered if that's not one of the most primary roles of parents, is to be a watchdog for your
child's gifts and to move them towards the full development of those. I'd like to just put one other word on the board to explore, which I think is an important one for our culture and its results.
Wasn't there a fourth?
Yeah, there's a fourth one called the other, and I don't mean to skip over it, but we've talked about it a little bit. Who should gifts be used for, you know, for in a private way or for the building up of the body? But if we could jump to results, let me try to phrase a question here that might be helpful to us in a short period of time. What I'd like to try to have us talk about is the notion of great works versus effectiveness. And I'd like you to take a look at, if King were worried only about effectiveness, if that was the main standard, then what would he have paid attention to? Couple sub-questions. If effectiveness is our main standard, will it cause us to scale back the vision? If our vision was to feed the world, and somebody said, well, how effective can we be at that? Bill, it's this complex global marketplace, and could it be that the question of effectiveness would cause us to scale it back, and say, okay, let's just worry about feeding Dayton, Ohio? And what if effectiveness was not the final standard? What if great works were? What if each of us were inspired to be committed to a great work in our life? I love that Mr. Holland's Opus, you know, that movie. He kept wanting to write this great work. And he didn't realize that his whole life was a great work of shaping young lives, you know. But I have this belief that effectiveness might be the hobgoblin that gets in the way of great works being hatched, great works being pursued, and possibly great works being achieved. Can we talk about that a little bit, both in light of the poem and also in light of our own lives? Dean and then Dan, I think.
This is kind of corny, but today we had, or for breakfast, we had scrambled eggs and potatoes. And I was on the wait ride. And my job was to take care of what was left of the scrambled eggs and potatoes. And you know that there were two big pans of scrambled eggs and potatoes that I had to throw away. And I don't think I've ever thought about it in the same way, except that we do waste a lot. But I was just thinking, here are these two big trays that haven't been touched in the sense that they would be contaminated, and yet we throw them away. Isn't there some way that, you know, I'm kind of asking a dumb question, but it just bothered me that here, look at all this waste, and those poor starving kids in India have never seen a scrambled egg.
Is it Mary?
It's Mary, yeah. I guess I was thinking about how that word effectiveness in our culture gets tied up with survivability. Can I do this and survive the experience? Will I be here tomorrow if I do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess where I first encountered that kind of thinking was when I was sitting on hospital boards in Catholic healthcare a few mm-hmm. years back. And DRGs were coming in.
What is a DRG?
A DRG is a diagnostic related group. It was Medicare was beginning to tighten the belt and saying you only get so much for an appendectomy no matter how long they're in the hospital. And then managed care was the next phase of that after Medicare had started. And I saw Catholic healthcare pulling back from its mission. I saw it worrying about its viability. And I saw a real struggle within boards to think about the mission to healthcare as a human right, okay?
Yeah.
Versus healthcare as a commodity to be sold.
Thank you, that's right.
And healthcare as a human right was not something you could hold on to and be effective in meeting your goals every year. It got results focused around, and it got focused around issues of viability. I'm in healthcare at the basic service end of it at this point. But boy, those same issues are invading every decision about who gets served in a particular clinic.
And I absolutely, Mary, believe what you're saying is that when effectiveness becomes the question, the marketplace becomes the answer in this culture. Everything becomes a commodity, including human life, including human dignity. And Mother Teresa was asked, Dean and I were talking about this, how is it that you're able to keep this ministry going day after day, week after week? You pray with the dying and they die. You feed the dying and they die. You give the dying a comfortable place to lay down and they die. What's effective about that ministry, is the question. And Mother Teresa says that a long time ago she had made a decision that it was for her ministry to flourish, she could not be concerned about effectiveness. She had to be more concerned about faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
But when capacities come into alignment with effectiveness, what we get is the marketplace. But could it be that when gifts come into alignment with faithfulness, we get radically different society, radically different institutions?
Our churches and my congregation is dealing with the bottom line on that. But let me come at it another way on that. The Sermon on the Mount, particularly interpreted in terms of Bonhoeffer's cost of discipleship, when he reflects about it, that phrase there, the right hand is not what the left hand is doing, or whichever that is, that you are not concerned here about the reaction, and somehow right action becomes in the sense that you don't have an objective in mind. You find the power to do it. And then you thought about me, because I was going to say something about Mother Teresa before, and
yeah.
I thought of that, because she is the one that exhibits it so powerfully in our modern world.
That reminds me of a wonderful story, if you'll permit me to tell it quickly. And I really enjoy the works of Parker Palmer, a theologian and an educator. I don't see many of his works in the bookstore, and I should have ordered some, but I refer you to him for some inspiring reflections. This is his reflection on the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. Now, the background of the story is kind of important, and those who know the Bible better, forgive me if I'm not completely accurate here. But the disciples had been commissioned. They'd been off on their own a little bit. They've out exploring their own gifts, and they decided they needed a team meeting. So Jesus calls them together, sort of like, how's it going group? And they decide to go off to a quiet place. And so they go across the lake. But the people are so hungry for the message that they walk around the lake and they follow them. And they're having this private little executive committee meeting. And the people appear, and it's getting to be towards evening, and the disciples sort of turn towards Jesus going, look at these people. They follow us here, and I bet they're hungry. And Jesus feels compassion. He says they're like sheep without a shepherd. And so once again, through compassion, Jesus begins to move towards the people, and the disciples say to Jesus, but what should we do? It's getting towards evening. There's not enough time for them to get home and have dinner. If they stay here all night, they'll be hungry. They could become restless. This could be a sort of an unhealthy scene. And Jesus' response says, what do we have? 5 loaves and some fish. Take all that we have and distribute it among the people. And what Parker Palmer says is that also the first thing that happened is that this huge crowd was put into circles of about 50 to 100. So now that they're known,
people. It's just not this anonymous crowd. There are relationships in the crowd. And as they watch this radical act of generosity, take all that we have and give it to the people, he's not concerned at all about effectiveness. He is concerned about faithfulness. And what Parker Palmer says is this radical act of generosity results in this. Somebody in the circle of 50 or 100 says, well, I did have this piece of fish here. I was saving my for myself till later. Maybe I can share it with my friend Connie. Well, you know, I did have this piece of cheese here that I was saving for midnight snack, but I see my friend Van is opening his pocket with some bread. Maybe I'll share it. And what Palmer concludes is that there's more gifts in the community, untapped gifts, unknown gifts, than anyone could have ever counted. And a radical act of generosity is what primes the pump. And now the community brings forth all of its resources, so much so that 12 baskets are filled with leftovers. And could it be that that's the reality of our, that could be the reality of our lives together, not one of scarcity, earned capacities, worried about effectiveness, getting mine because there's only so much, but a radical faith in a God who bestows gifts, who would have us use them to build up the body, that if we would radically believe that and be more concerned about faithfulness than effectiveness, that this could be a different world. Well, sorry for that sermon. Other comments before we have to wrap here. What else is speaking to you in this poem about anything? Motives, the other, results?
Bill, I just want to talk about a bell stand.
Yep.
There is one up there. You know, and I noticed it on my second day here, and I was watching, looking at its construction, its engineering, and its all that kind of stuff, and thinking that a bell stand, all you need is sort of like two upright, then you know, something to hang it on, something to base it, and that'd be very efficient. And whoever did that over there was thinking a lot more than just of having some portable thing. But in here, it took 7 days before he even got to the point where he could go do something. That's incredibly inefficient, yet alone not effective. But what goes into the planning, the thinking, the visioning, what is this all about, where are we going? What do we really want to produce as different from what the specs might say?
Beautiful. Thanks.
I think it's pretty outstanding how he gives the tree humanism by meeting it. You know, he walks into a forest and he meets a tree, almost as he was led to the tree, guided. Pine tree.
Tree of the vow.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you say some more about that? That's one of the points I wanted to get to.
Well, I mean, I just think of the whole Martin Buber thing, that sort of, you know, but there are many other ways you could come at that too, because Eastern traditions that are probably rooted in here, the sacredness of that tree and of that particular tree, and the term encounter here, that you meet this on the same level. I mean, it's not something you would use, but something, it is a sacred being, which also is the partner now in the task of, you know, making the bell stand.
Couldn't do it without the tree.
And that very, you know, that very clear. The first thing I picked up, you couldn't do it without the tree. And that tree that sort of presents itself for you, and the bell stand is in the tree.
It's almost like a dance.
The other image I was thinking of was Michelangelo meeting that flawed piece of marble that everybody else had thrown away, and said, nothing can be done with it, and he made the David out of it, because the David was in it, and he just brought out what was there.
In an earlier session last week, I confessed my interest in the roots of words, and we talked about the root of the word humility.
which comes from a Latin word, humus, the stuff in the forest floor. And that I think humility has got a bad rap in our culture, because I think it's wrongly understood as some sort of self-deprecation. If I'm humble, I will sort of whip myself into submission by, you know, admitting to myself all my faults. But if humility, what I begin to see is that I'm made of the same stuff as the forest floor, made of the same stuff as the tree. For those that don't like that, I like to remind us that we're made of the same stuff as the stars. There's no new stuff in the universe. When I recognize that we are of the same stuff, then it is possible to have that encounter and to be in right relationship. And then beauty emerges. Brad and then Dean.
It reminds me of a comment I heard some time ago that struck home with me, which about humility. It said, give yourself permission to be ordinary.
Huh, thank you.
And that's for people who feel they must be extraordinary or else they're not worth anything. I brought that statement home and I told my high-achieving family what I thought was a wonderful statement. And my children thought it was terrible. Give yourself permission to be ordinary? They said, give yourself permission to be extraordinary. But I like the first one better. That's what I need to hear. And maybe there are others in the room who need to hear it too.
I'm drawn to that one myself, mostly because at the age of 46 in the last 6 months I have run headlong into my mortality.
Yes.
And being ordinary is just fine.
Yeah.
Dean.
We could use this application of his meditation, his fasting for these 7 days, then going out in the forest as changing the forest into human beings, and through the fasting and the praying, we were able to see in other people the good and the possibilities that they have, and not the faults that they have, but using this quiet time to, maybe for your children, your wife, or your husband, that you use this quiet time to change your values and attitudes and see a potential there, that dismiss all of the distractions. Maybe there's a potential there that needs to be drawn out.
And having done this for 7 years now, I feel like it's one of those sort of positive addictions, I suppose. I have a friend who says now, if he doesn't go within, he goes without. Duane?
I have a question about your process. How did this text find you?
It's a good question. While trying to, that's a great question actually. There's a little bit of a story behind it, and it involves a Lutheran. I was starting this Center for Ethical Leadership about 7 years ago, and this person, and Duane, you may, and Brad, you may know him, it's a person from Minneapolis who runs something called the ARC. It's a retreat center. What's?
Lauren Hoverson?
Lauren.
Is it a woman?
No, it's a male.
Lauren and Ruth Hoverson.
Yeah, Lauren. So anyway, Lauren was visiting his son in Seattle, who plays a musical instrument, and I think for one of the professional organizations in town. And he asked the question of somebody. He said, "Well, what's going on in town? What's going new?" And I'm sort of like, "Who can I have an interesting breakfast with?" So somebody told him to call me up, and he said, "Bill, I'm in town visiting my son. I've heard you're doing some interesting stuff, and I'd like to have breakfast with you." And I said, "Okay." So Saturday morning, went out to speak to him, and he said, "Well, Bill, tell me what you're going to do." And I said, "Well, I'm going to go into the corporate sector, and I'm going to begin relations there, and I'm going to start this ethical leadership in the corporate sector, and I'm going to go into the government sector, and I'm going to begin to talk about values in the workplace and begin that work there. And then I'm going to go into neighborhoods, and I'm going to start to work with neighborhood leaders and begin a project there that helps to bring out the gifts in neighborhoods. And he listened for about 3 minutes, and he looked at me and he said, "No, you're not." I go, "Wait a minute, you called me up." He said, "Wait a minute, what's going on?" I said, "Okay." I said, "If I'm not, what am I?" I said, "Why not?" He said, "Bill, you don't have to go in and begin any of that." And I said, "What?" He said, "Bill, God has already been there before you. God's spirit is already there in the corporate sector, already there in the government sector, already in the neighborhoods. If you'll just go into those communities and cooperate with the spirit of God that's already there," he said, "you'll have a much easier time." And then about a year later, I ran into this poem, and then I understood what he meant. Anything else? If not, I'd like to just end with this brief reflection. How does this sound like a plan to begin an organization? Be born in poverty, receive no formal education, practice a trade, sort of give it up and go on a spiritual journey. Develop some points of view that you'd like to share with the rest of the world. Get about 12 people around you who are willing to work with you. Raise enough questions that causes the status quo to want to get rid of you. Continue to raise those questions and have the status quo take you to a place called Golgotha and nail you to a cross where you die. And have the 12 people that you would have seen as your closest allies, for the most part, go their separate ways out of fear. Does that sound like an effective plan to build an organization? And as I think about that, and the work, the great work that we're all capable of, is that what would it mean to be more concerned about faithfulness than effectiveness as we continue to pursue the great works in the corners of our hearts? Thanks a lot.